Mr. Shinoda, could you at this point give us an idea about the Arts Center, a little bit of its history, and why it was preeminent in automotive design curricula in the country, I guess, at that time?
Well, actually, the Art Center College of Design was started by a fellow named Tink Adams, who had worked in the, I believe, in the advertising and design business in New York and in the Detroit area. Mm-hmm. And he formed the school in 1930 in Los Angeles, and it was made up, the faculty were basically people from Detroit.
Really?
George Jurgensen, who'd worked at General Motors as a designer.
Uh-huh.
And there was a John Coleman, who was a product designer that had worked in New York, and he would spin all kinds of tales of how they did things back in the old days.
And, uh-huh, that's been fascinating.
And then there were some illustrators that had worked for the top illustration agencies, so.
Mm-hmm.
And another fellow that was quite prominent was a fellow named Strother McMinn,
who's still there, I believe.
He's still there, yes. He's yeah. He's still on their staff. And
had he come on from General Motors?
Yes.
Was he disenchanted, or he just wanted to retire?
Well, I think, I'm not really sure just why, you know, I know the guy is a very good designer, and I don't know why he decided not to, you know, pursue the design business.
He preferred to teach.
Right, and he's an excellent teacher.
When did he come out to the Art Center, Strother McMinn?
I believe it was probably in the early 50s.
That early, huh? So yeah. He was one of the founding, but he was one of the very early resident.
George Jurgensen was actually, had preceded him, and he was at the school, and then at later years he was a chairman of the industrial design department.
How do you spell his last name?
Jurgensen, J-U-R-G, I guess it's a
S-E-N.
Yes.
Jurgensen, probably.
Yeah.
S-E-N.
I'm not sure if it's S-E-N or S-O-N.
S-O-N.
I'm not sure just how the spelling was, but he was one of the earliest people, and then he retired from Art Center and actually came back and took a job with General Motors as sort of a design PR type.
Did he really?
Right.
Oh. I think I remember that name. Yeah. What was his first name again?
George. Everybody just called him Jergy.
Uh-huh. Now, so you found it very hospitable when you got there. I mean, at least exciting.
Well,
exciting.
It was exciting, but basically I didn't really do very much as far as I went to the school for about four semesters, and all the time I was there, I never had a chance to draw a car. They kind of miscast me a little bit. They had me in all kinds of classes that didn't pertain to what I wanted to learn. So
I was
somewhat disenchanted.
Why was that? Did you ever?
I never really understood why, but for some reason or other, they just didn't figure I was going to be a car designer.
Hmm.
So after I left the school, I worked at Douglas Aircraft.
Did you leave it somewhat disenchanted?
Yeah, pretty much so.
Yeah.
And then this John Coleman called me one day and says, "Why don't you come in and interview for a job?" Ford was out to interview people.
John Coleman was?
He was a product designer. He was not the, and he taught a class in airbrush, which I'd done quite well with.
Uh-huh. You'd become very, very good with an airbrush. Huh?
Right. So he said, "Well, bring some drawings in and do some sketches." So I came in and I worked all night doing some sketches.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to borrow some paintings that I'd sold.
Working up a quick portfolio.
Quick portfolio. And one of them.
Where was the interview held?
Right at the school, at Art Center.
Oh, okay, fine. And a team from Ford Motor Company's design department of the early 50s.
Right. In fact, the person, the designer that came out to interview was Jean Bordonnais.
Bordonnais is an interesting character in Ford design history. Not to anticipate you, but did you find your interview with him, can you describe the interview? I understand it was rather an interesting confrontation between you and they. Can you describe Bordonnais and his reaction and then your impression?
Well, he came in as a very stuffy person and he used a lot of big words that,
yeah.
that I didn't know what they meant. Like, He said their modus operandi was such, and he sat on his chair backwards, you know.
Oh, really?
He sat on the chair.
Oh, yes, one of his typical tricks, yeah.
Tricks,
yeah.
And he...
leaning his...
Right, his chin on the back of the chair.
Yeah. He talked about modus operandi and...
different things that I didn't understand at that time, what the hell he was talking about.
Who else was with him, do you remember?
There was, the other fellow was a personnel guy, and I can't remember his name.
Yeah.
But, and I think the thing that startled him probably more than anything else was when I handed him, when we finally agreed on some sorts of terms, I handed him a job contract.
You'd already typed it up, huh?
No, it wasn't typed, it was all handwritten.
Handwritten, huh?
And,
I recall you... you were dressed rather in contrast to their three-button suits. And
I had on a Hawaiian shirt with a T-shirt underneath the Hawaiian shirt that said Howard Racing Cams. And I had some denim peg pants with some loose white shoes. And
it's fashion in those days.
Well, it was kind of the fashion for me. And it's
you must have shocked stuffy old Jean Bourdonnais.
Yeah, I think I did kind of shock him. And then he said, well, why would you want to come to work for us? I said, well, I come to work for you because I can make you money.
Mm-hmm.
And
that took him aback.
And and you need me, and I don't really need you.
What was his response to this?
What do you mean? We need you. I said, well, you need me to show you how to design good cars that'll make you money.
Mm-hmm.
And
a novel approach.
And I don't really need you because what you're offering, I make more money here, and I don't, and I can dress like this,
uh-huh.
And I don't have to have a coat. I don't have to worry about snow.
To stuffy corporate practices.
So they had a little conference, and then they finally decided, well, okay,
What do you think of your drawings?
They liked the drawings. They're particularly, they asked some questions about a couple different things. One was a wheel cover design,
mm-hmm.
and the other one was basically some tail fins on a car.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the sketches weren't complete cars. They were sketches of just components of the car.
Yeah.
And they asked, well, why did I sketch that way? I said, well, there's an idea for a tail fin. Here's an idea for a wheel cover. Here's an idea for a wheel opening. And
mm-hmm.
I says, if I want to spend a lot of time, I can put it all together and do it all in one car. But
mm-hmm.
then it's only one sketch. Here I can provoke you with seven small sketches rather than one.
Right.
To do the one large sketch, it could easily be out of drawing and you would not look at it, but as a detail, it'll be more interesting to you.
They were fascinated by that approach.
Yeah, I guess people, they did big drawings, they did complete cars, and
yeah.
I did a lot of small,
yeah.
and they were all on yellow typing paper.
Well, as you probably anticipated, if they did hire you, that's probably the sort of thing you'd be doing at the beginning.
Right.
Bits and pieces, yeah.
So basically they agreed that they would pay me not what they were paying the graduate students. It was slightly less, but close.
Did that conform to your job contract?
And my job contract said at the end of 6 months, if I'm doing the proper job, then they'll pay me X number of dollars, which was $100 more than the starting guys were making.
Great.
And at that point in time, if I wasn't doing the satisfactory job, then I'd pay my own way home.
You'd be stranded in Deerburg. Huh?
Yeah, I'd pay my own way home. And it's, they said, aren't you being a little presumptuous? And I says, no. I said,
a one-way ticket, eh?
I'm not going to have to pay my own way home.
Yeah, right. That's great. Gee, Gene must have really thought that was incredible.
Well,
But he was impressed.
I think he was impressed, but he... Of course, I don't think he ever really liked me.
Really?
Yeah, because in later years...
You never really got on.
Well...
But this initial period...
In fact, I worked in his studio. And,
which was what? Which studio was
it? Actually, I didn't. Where I worked for him right initially was a studio that reported to him. It was an advanced studio.
Okay.
And we worked on a Mercury Turnpike cruiser car.
Now, who was heading up that advanced studio in those days?
Well, in this case, it was a fellow named John Najar.
Okay.
John Najar ran the studio,
mm-hmm.
but it came right under Bourdonnais.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, George Walker was the vice president.
Mm-hmm. So you were working on advanced concepts, obviously. Yeah,
that was just for a short time. And then...
the Turnpike still exists. It's in California. Someone owns it. that original prototype.
Was that right?
Yeah. If you like, I'll give you the gentleman's name. If you'd like to.
That's amazing.
I'd like to contact you too.
But then we got caught up, and I ended up in Lincoln's studio.
How'd that come about?
Well, there started out a design contest, and
among the younger designers.
Right. Well, not all the designers. All on this, to do this new Lincoln, and
The one that they were thinking about in the mid-50s.
Yeah, and this was so. Elwood Engel was there, and he chose me to be part of his team. So we went into. So I worked for him.
Did you?
And there was a.
Now he was what was he then?
He was one of the directors, or actually he was right under. He was George Walker's man. So
right. Uh-huh. He and Joe Orris were the two lieutenants, right?
Right, I think so.
Yeah.
And the actual studio. I forget who was actually running the studio, but there were and the opposing studio of a fellow, Arulo Conrad, was running that part of the studio, and actually he had a much nicer looking car.
Did he?
This car that I worked on with Elwood was really it became the 58 Lincoln. It's a pretty terrible car. It's not something to be proud of.
What was this gentleman's name again? Arulo?
Rulo Conrad.
Oh, Rulo Conrad, yeah.
Right.
How you spelling?
Just R-U-L-O.
Okay, Conrad. Now, he was in, what studio was he in?
Well, he was also part of Lincoln's studio, but
separate, A and B.
Huh? Yeah, he ran one design, and Elwood Engel did the other design, and Elwood's design was kind of off the wall.
Was it?
Yeah, it was really kind of off the wall.
Did you help him with that?
Yeah, I did. So, in fact, some of the ideas are mine.
Ah, okay. And that won the competition, and that became the 58
Lincoln.
Uh-huh. Were you involved in any of the Continental business at all?
No. The Continental business
Mark
was
II.
Going on, and the Mark II. I knew some of the designers who were involved, but uh-huh. That was kind of, the elite crew worked on that.
Can you describe your sensations on arriving in Dearborn and working for the design center in those days? Some of your impressions?
My first impressions coming to Detroit were fairly poor because I
cut off. You're in Los Angeles, are you? Well, you worked in Minneapolis.
I was just in the service, and it was.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Of course, I'd been through one winter there, so I knew what to expect.
Mm-hmm.
When I got into Willow Run, I got on this old rickety Crayon bus. And it was roaring coming down Michigan Avenue, seeing all this kind of a blackish brown snow.
Oh my God!
It was all covered with soot.
Awful pollution in those days, yeah, right.
And then seeing if you go down Michigan Avenue, you kind of see the Skid Row area of Detroit.
Right. Yeah. You were coming up Michigan Avenue from the bus.
So then I stayed in this Statler Hotel, which was right downtown.
Not too bad.
That was a nice hotel.
Yeah, good restaurants. Yeah.
And then I took a cab out to the design center. And the deal was, and the contract was that I would stay in a hotel until they found proper housing in West Dearborn.
Uh-huh.
Well, I think about the second or third day, they sent me over to the Fortson Hotel in East Dearborn.
The Fortson Hotel?
Yeah. I walked into the hotel, they gave me my key, went up the room, I set my suitcase down, I turned the lights on, and I saw these things moving around on the bed. They were bed bugs. So I immediately grabbed my suitcase, went down, gave them back their keys. The cab hadn't left yet, so I got back in the cab and went back to the Statler.
Oh my God, Fortson Hotel?
Yeah.
I don't think it still exists.
No, I don't think so either.
It seems. Thank heavens.
Yeah. So they said, what was wrong with that? I said, well, you go stay there.
Who said that?
The people at Ford.
Oh, some personal people.
So then they arranged one room for me, so I went over there after work, and when I got there, the woman wouldn't rent me the room.
She wouldn't?
No, she
said. Oh, because of your Japanese accent?
Yeah, we don't rent to foreigners.
Oh, yeah, it was terrible here in Dearborn in those days.
And so then you'd call up and you'd tell them, well, I'm Japanese American, And they'd say, oh, yeah, no problem. So you'd go over. When you get there, they'd say, oh, we're sorry, we just rented the room.
I'm not laughing because it's funny, but because it was so typical of Dearborn in those days.
Yeah, so, the stories about Mayor Hubbard seeing this black person shot 14 times in the back, saying, oh, the worst case of suicide I've ever seen.
Far from the truth.
Yeah. But things were pretty tough, and I think I finally did get a room over on Military, and so I stayed there for a while.
Well, how was the atmosphere in the were you received? Were you well received by your fellow young designers?
And yeah, there's no problem there.
No problem there. Huh? Do you remember some of the guys that you worked with that you remember with affection or friendliness?
Yeah, there was I can't remember all the names, but there was a fellow Phillips. I don't know whatever happened to him.
His last name was Phillips?
Phillips, then there was...
Of course, you worked with John Najjar. How'd you find him?
Yeah, Najjar was really a pleasant guy to work
with.
Yeah, right, yeah. He was kind of a little bit of a worrywart, and he was
kind of fussy.
Busy, you know.
Yeah, always, yeah.
Always wanted, you'd have all these charts and all these... Well, you know, he had procedures, and if you didn't follow those, well, then, you know, you're in trouble. So. But he always got along fine with John.
That's good, yeah.
And there are several fellows that all started at the same time that I did.
Do you remember
anything? A fellow named Jerry Morrison, who's still there.
Uh-huh.
And
what was his discipline?
He's an industrial designer. He was from Art Center.
Uh-huh.
And a fellow named Paul Wong, who's still there. He's in interiors.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
There's a whole bunch of them.
How did you find the studio head starting with? Did you meet Mr. Walker while you were there?
Yes.
What did you think of him?
He seemed to be very pleasant.
Mm-hmm. Very affable, very...
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, he was very, very pleasant. I guess he was a hell of a salesman. So.
He sure was. What about Joe Orris? Did you ever come in contact
with
him?
Yeah, Joe Orris... I think we finally understood one another. I didn't know him when I first came.
Uh-huh.
When I came back the second time.
Oh, okay. Then he was just still there. Yeah.
Then at this point in time, we're kind of on the same basic levels.
Right. Uh-huh.
So we'd get into these directors' meetings, and so after they kind of run over me, I finally figured, well, the hell with it. Now I better get up, say my piece. So
good.
Kind of practice my,
uh-huh. What'd you say?
Well, I'd stand my ground and, just...
Your designs,
Well, designs and policies, because there were
uh-huh.
Big policy meetings, director of meetings, where, saying which studio the new designers were going and...
I see. Uh-huh. Reassignments?
Reassignments, and, of course, I did everything I could to build as big an empire as I could in a short time.
Right.
Uh-huh. I guess one thing I really got to them was that they shoved me in a studio in the basement.
The basement of the design center?
Design center.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a fellow named Bob Husser was working for me. And
Husser
and some other fellows. And we started doing just special vehicles. And at that point in time, I worked for Don Della Rosa.
Oh, okay.
And so they would store all the blackboards, the big movable 20-foot blackboards, down in the hall.
Oh, great.
So it got to the point I would go out with a staple puller and would remove all the stuff off the boards, throw in the dumpsters,
mm-hmm.
put a new, none of them had tags on them.
Uh-huh.
So I had tags made up that said Special Projects Design Office.
Good.
And a number.
Uh-huh.
We'd stack them on the ends of them, would bring them in the studio, and so we'd have little studios within the studio to do some hidden projects.
Great.
And pretty soon I got to the point they couldn't find any blackboards.
You'd corral them all.
I'd corral them almost. I think I left the two rickiest ones out in the hall. The wheels were falling off. And some people were looking for some interior materials that were, and they'd all been put in a dumpster. But some of them, there were actually like 11 layers of material tacked on the board.
Wow.
That never, got rid of any. They just put new covers and re-tacked the stuff on.
Mm-hmm.
So,
what sort of reaction did you get to that?
Well, then they finally had to order new ones.
Uh-huh. So you kept them?
Well, we kept them, uh-huh. Right. In fact, we moved them all up to the, when I finally got a studio upstairs, we moved them all upstairs. And so we could do almost anything. We could segregate things, and people would walk in the studios and they wouldn't see what was going on. And it used to puzzle some of the people. But,
some of the older people.
In fact, I guess it was several months after I left, they finally repainted the doors.
Really?
I'd painted the doors, the movable doors, competition orange. They had been sort of corporate blue or
mm-hmm,
a dark green, or they were very muted colors.
Competition oriented.
And the entry door was white, so.
Would that become known as Larry Shinoda's hideaway?
Yeah, more or less, and then, so. Several months later, they finally got him painted back to corporate blue. And I guess. I guess someone overheard Bourdonnais and Della Rosa stand there saying, "Oh, he finally got rid of the son of a bitch."
Well, those two characters were no saying, certainly had no right to call anybody a son of a bitch. What was your relationship with Della Rosa? How did you find him as a person, as a designer?
As a designer, I didn't care for his taste.
You didn't care for it, huh?
No. Mm-hmm. As a person, he seemed like, you know, he always struck me as a very pleasant, nice sort, but he would get kind of nasty, drunk, nasty mean when he got drunk.
Yeah, apparently had a drinking problem.
Yeah, but normally he was very congenial and design-wise.
What was wrong with his designs?
Well, he had a tendency to do things pretty puffy.
Rather baroque.
Yeah, rather baroque, and like he did this, I guess he personally did this car called the Flashback. Which was kind of
about that. What's it about?
Well, it was a real small car. Would have been smaller than would have been almost like an Austin A7 type of vehicle.
Uh-huh.
And it had some sort of swoopy lines, and it had, you know, but it was very narrow and it was quite short. So that was sort of kind of an epitome of his type design.
Design philosophy.
And well, even some of the Chrysler cars
seem to show that.
Well, so one of them, all the cars were very, very stiff, very formal, and then this 600E came out, and suddenly it got kind of chunky. The trunk got kind of chunky looking, and I was told that was his influence.
Della Rosa's influence. Yeah. So, were you happy there? Was it a learning experience?
Ford was really a learning experience. Because
just year. What year was it?
The year of 1955 was the first year, and then I was there just the 1 year, then I went to Packard.
Yeah, but what was going on? And 55 was quite a. They were really beginning to the 55 car went very well, didn't it? As far as sales, and they were looking into the Edsel at this time, and they're looking into the Mark II. Kind of a lot of ferment going on in the design department.
Right.
Must have been an interesting place to be for a time.
Yeah, it was an interesting place to be. And then it was. I guess Walker didn't want me to go, and so. He gave me an offer, which I told him all I would accept.
Uh-huh.
And then when the personnel people got the offer, they told him no way.
Because it was much more than your level was getting?
Right. Uh-huh. So they couldn't give me the same pay, so I left and went to Packard.
How did you get recruited to Packard? How did that come about?
Well, they were, you know, starting a new studio, a Clipper studio, and they brought in a fellow from GM to run the studio. A fellow named Dwayne Bonstead.
Bonstead?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Who's recently retired from GM.
Oh, has he? Uh-huh. How do you spell that last name?
Bohnstedt.
Okay.
Now, he came over from Chevrolet, and then there was a fellow who I was rooming with, Atoshi Sako. Now, he was S-A-K-O-W.
Uh-huh.
Now, he is also Japanese. Uh-huh. He was born in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
He, his parents lived down Trumbull and Forest.
Oh.
Really nice neighborhood.
Yeah, right.
And so I roomed there. We used to call it Cockroach Manor.
But it was fun, huh?
Yeah, so then he talked me into coming to work at Packard. And then they paid me like $200 a month more than I was making at Ford.
Wow.
So
they were in trouble, weren't they?
Yeah.
What was the situation there at Packard? Can you sketch it briefly?
When it started, we were working heavy overtime. We were doing this car called the Clipper.
And this was supposed to be the one that was going to revive their fortune.
Yeah, this was, would have been a 57 model.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
this is in 56 that you're there.
Right.
Yeah.
So we worked like crazy for about 4 months.
Mm-hmm.
And then the models were done. They shipped the models out to the die shop. I'm not sure where the dye shop was, but it was locally.
Local dye shop.
Yeah, it was a local dye shop, and the dye shop sent it back and said, "Cash first."
They were convinced that they would never be paid if they didn't be paid up front.
Yeah, right. So they wanted the payment up front, so the model came back, and that just started the decline right there. We just
weren't able to come up with the kind of.
No, so.
Who was running the company in those days? Was that Jim Nance?
Right.
He'd been brought in from another company to sort of become the doctor.
Right.
To revive the sinking company. Had it merged with Studebaker yet?
Yes, it had.
It has. So that was the Packard Clipper was an amalgam of the big Packard and the small Clipper.
No. Yes, well, the Clipper, this was going to be an all-new car, but it was a smaller smaller version of the Packard.
Yeah. Who worked with you on the design there?
Well, there was a fellow named Fred Hudson.
Hudson, mm-hmm.
And there was a fellow named John Ewart.
How do you spell that?
E-W-E-R-T.
Mm-hmm.
And there was an illustrator, Walt Mihalik.
How do you spell that?
It's M-I-H... I-L-I-K, I think. I'm not quite sure, but I think he's at Chrysler.
Is he
still? Still at Chrysler.
How about Bill Schmidt? Was he still there?
Yeah, Bill Schmidt was a vice president.
Of design. Huh?
And Dick Teague was the chief designer.
Oh, yes. At this point, was the predictor in the
right,
picture?
That was already done.
It had been done?
Right.
And who had done that? Do you remember?
Well, the predictor, Teague took all the credit for it, but...
He did.
A fellow named Dick Collier, and I think this Fred Hudson had quite a bit to do with it.
Oh, really? How about Dick McAdam?
No, Dick McAdam was probably the key guy.
Was he? And then
yeah.
And the other two you mentioned were also key men. Turns out that Schmidt and Teague took the credit for it.
Yeah, right.
But it was really McAdam and who?
McAdam, Dick Collier, and a fellow named Fred Hudson.
Yeah. It wasn't a bad automobile, stylistically. It was rather exciting, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think it... It did a few things that the Edsel didn't do that that kind of gave it a little more distinct look.
A little more tasteful than the Edsel,
right.
Not so garish. Yeah. And this was to be the car that would revive the company's fortunes.
Right.
But what happened?
Well, then it all kind of went down the tube, and then people were asked, you can stay here and work on your portfolio, or if you want to, we'll send you down a South Bend, you can transfer to South Bend,
mm-hmm.
or you can come down and help me scrape my boat. So Schmidt.
Who's that?
Schmidt.
Bill Schmidt.
So I decided to go racing, so I went to Minneapolis, and they sent my check to the Speedway every other Tuesday.
Really?
Right on the,
still getting paid, huh?
Right on the dot, yeah.
Wow.
So I was in Indianapolis for about 2.5 months.
Really?
Then I came back and I spent a few days on my portfolio,
mm-hmm.
and then I finally got an interview at General Motors, and so I went over there.
Well, what happened when you say they put some of you on extended duty? You could have, because of the South Bend connection, the Studebaker end of it was holding firm.
Right.
And the Packard was going down the drain.
Right.
Yeah. So they hoped that the Studebaker mark would survive for another.
Right.
2 or 3 years. So in you fact, could have gone to the Studebaker design unit.
Then. Right. No, I didn't want to. So.
Didn't want to do that. Yeah. Any particular reason why?
No, it just didn't make any sense. I'd, mm-hmm. I'd made one visit down there just tonight.
Really?
Yeah, I couldn't see any spot for, you know.
There was really no.
Right.
And then, what did you do in the way of racing in Indianapolis for this month?
Well, I'd worked, in 1955, I'd worked on this A.J. Watson's crew. And the car won the race with Bob Swikert, right?
Really?
So I attended a lot of races.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 1956, I was working at Packard, and I'd worked with the new car owner that Watson was working with, and he had a stock car, Pontiac.
Uh-huh.
And, before he got the car, he asked me, what do you think? What would you order for a race car?
Mm-hmm.
So I can have anything I want from Pontiac. So I told him I'd get the Catalina two-door sedan.
Uh-huh.
So why not the four-door hardtop, or the two-door hardtop? I said, well, it's going to be several hundred pounds heavier,
uh-huh.
which it was.
Uh-huh.
And I don't think aerodynamically it's going to be any better. So I talked him into lowering the front drastically and lowering the rear, but the rear was a little bit higher, so the car had some very negative rake. And
mm-hmm.
we stripped the whole interior out completely.
Right. This is stock car racing.
The hood, front fenders, I had those, had him ship them to Detroit. There was a place here that did acid etching.
Really?
So we acid etched the hood, the front fenders, the doors.
What would that do?
Well, it chemically mills the material down, gauge. So just, you know, it just eats away a certain amount of the metal.
Oh, I see, or you're lightening the metal.
Yeah, so you take it out and you, so we lighten the car, we even lighten the front bumpers. Front bumper, rear bumper was lightened.
By that process?
Same material, same process, and then replated. But, you know, he said money was no object, he wanted to, so got the car quite a bit lighter and lower. And the first runs at Daytona was quicker than the factory cars by quite a bit. So Knutson and the whole bunch all came over looking at the car.
Now, by Knutson, you mean?
Funky Knutson.
Who was then general manager of Pontiac.
Pontiac, right. Mm-hmm. And he couldn't figure out how a bunch of goddamn Okies could have a car that would run so fast. And this Jack Sink says, well, he says, my friend here